Hey, thanks so much for listening to this message. My name is Jason, and I'm one of the ministers here at the Madison Church of Christ. It's our hope and prayer that the teaching you hear today will bless your life and draw you closer to God. If you're ever in the Madison area, we'd love for you to stop by and study the Bible with us on Sundays at 5 p.m. or Wednesdays at 7 p.m. If you have questions about the Bible or want to know more about the Madison Church, you can find us online at madisonchurch.org. Be sure to subscribe to this podcast, as well as our sermons podcast, Madison Church of Christ Sermons. Thanks again for stopping by. I hope this study is a blessing to you.
All right, so we are going to go ahead and get started. I just wanted to put this slide on the screen as we are beginning. And these are just a few of the things that we've been through so far. With relation to Egypt specifically in the life of Moses. So right here we have the feather of Ma'at being weighed against a human heart. That sort of dealt with like the hard heartness possibly of Pharaoh. We have Pharaoh with the shepherd's crook. We have Moses' name originally being an Egyptian name, Moshe, meaning to like draw out of the water. We have God constantly saying, like, I'm going to, like, strike you with a mighty hand or a mighty fist or I'm going to, with an outstretched arm. We have people doing mud brick building. We have this random land of Goshen that was actually separate from any of their capital cities and stuff like that. We have the idea that Pharaoh is a god and the whole Exodus account essentially referring back to that. Here is what I think is just interesting. And I wanted to, like, prior to going on, I would... don't want to miss saying this. So going to the next slide. One of the biggest things about the story of Exodus, about really the Pentateuch as a whole, is a lot of people who are atheists or who may not just believe in the validity of these scriptures say, like, hey, this stuff, like, we don't have any evidence of it coming onto the scene until like 200 or 300 BC, which was hundreds, if not thousands of years after when you're claiming these accounts happened, yada, yada, yada. A lot of people don't believe it. This is one of the most interesting aspects of this whole thing to me, because when you read this story and the way that we've been reading it, you start not just seeing Hebrew and Israeli-based stuff. You start seeing stuff that's from an ancient culture that is far beyond when this Hebrew culture existed, and that wasn't really relative to the scene during the days that they claim that Hebrews would have written all of this. So what's really interesting to me, looking back at this story, is just the amount of Egyptian stuff in this story. It's wild. Egyptian stuff is just spread out everywhere. And to me, at least, and to most people out there, that is a super, super good marker that this stuff is valid and that it's historically accurate and that it was written when they're claiming that it was written. All right, so if you have your Bibles, we have been going through Exodus. I don't think I explained this at the beginning. I don't think I thought it was important enough. But in the original, like, Hebrew Bible, there were not, I'll say in the original Torah scroll, so the first five books of the Old Testament, there were not chapter and verse breakdowns. And what's really, really interesting is when you go back and read it, though, it's just these blocks of consonants. It's really hard to get through, but the way that a lot of people over time have kind of like connected these into sections and stuff, and the way that a lot of rabbis connected these sections, is they started to find words that just appeared a lot. And what they began to realize is Moses and these other authors, a lot of times in certain areas of these passages, would use a word or an idea a lot more than other words and ideas. So the first way that they broke apart this scroll so that they could read it in the temple or later on in synagogues and stuff like that is by taking these words, taking these sections, dividing it up by like a massive block or a massive section. In a lot of the ancient temple readings, the beginning of Exodus has like three or four really small scenes, but the big block of a section actually ends at the very end of where we're going to get through today. So you could almost call what we've done so far like Act 1 or composition one of Exodus or something like that. It kind of ended at this point. I'm going to explain how some of those words worked. But if you remember, we've been through like Exodus 1 through 4. That's the whole story of Moses, his life growing up, his life going fleeing after killing an Egyptian to Midian, him coming back, him confronting Pharaoh, before that him being at the burning bush. And we talked about a lot of the things that Moses went through, being rescued from the water, approaching God at Mount Horeb, which would later be Mount Sinai. All these other things were things that later on the Israelites as a whole were going to have to face. So that's Exodus 1 through 4. And then the last little bit, we've talked about the beginning of the section where Moses is really challenging Pharaoh and saying, like, let my people go, or let God's people go. And some of it's working, some of it's not. And then finally, God sends these plagues or these strikes upon the Egyptians. And then we talked last week how those were almost done in sets of three in the way that the language worked. But it could have been towards the Egyptian gods. It definitely was to let them know who God was as a being and as a creator. And then there's like a decreation aspect that we talked about. But then at the end of all of those first nine plagues, we have the big plague, the plague that God predicted in Exodus chapter 4, actually, when Moses originally comes to Pharaoh, says, let my people go. Pharaoh says, no. God looks at Moses and is essentially like, hey, I'm going to like put down his firstborn son because of this. Prophesies it in advance. And then we get to this section that we're in today. All that we're going to be talking about in this class is the 10th plague and the Passover and how that originated and stuff. There's this huge block of like two and a half chapters where suddenly the story of Moses and the Israelites as a story stops, and it's almost like instructions begin to appear where the Israelites are being told, you must do this, you must do that for generations to come. We'll talk about that a little bit. I wanted to say at the beginning, I'm not going to ask a question about this, but anytime I hear a Lord's Supper remark on this, it happens to like be about this. But it's September 11th today, and there are a whole lot of memorials that deal with September 11th, obviously for a very, very good reason. So because of that, today we're specifically talking about a ceremony, a thing that the Israelites did in order to remember. And I think today, more than any other day, we probably can relate to how some of them felt through this. So Exodus chapter 11, it's the short one. We're going to have a lot of discussion, but to do that, I'm just going to read tonight, and I'm going to try to read fast. So Exodus chapter 11, verse 1. Now the Lord had said to Moses, I will bring one more plague on Pharaoh and on Egypt. After that, he will let you go from here, and when he does, he will drive you out completely. Tell the people that men and women alike are to ask their neighbors for articles of silver and gold. The Lord made the Egyptians favorably disposed towards the people, and Moses himself was highly regarded in Egypt by Pharaoh's officials and by the people. So Moses said, this is what the Lord says, he's speaking to Pharaoh, about midnight I will go throughout Egypt. Every firstborn son in Egypt will die, from the firstborn son of Pharaoh who sits on the throne to the firstborn son of the female slave who is at her handmill, and all the firstborn of the cattle as well. There will be loud wailing throughout Egypt, worse than there has ever been or will ever be again. But among the Israelites, not a dog will bark at any person or animal. Then you will know that the Lord makes a distinction between Egypt and Israel. All these officials of yours will come to me, bowing down before you and saying, go, you and all the people who follow you. After that, I will leave. Then Moses, hot with anger, left Pharaoh. The Lord had said to Moses, Pharaoh will refuse to listen to you so that my wonders may be multiplied in Egypt. Moses and Aaron performed all these wonders before Pharaoh, but the Lord hardened Pharaoh's heart, and he would not let the Israelites go out of the country. All right, so as I'm reading this, like, all these questions just come from, like, kind of what I'm thinking as I read this. So why do you think the Egyptians began to be favorably disposed to the Israelites? This, like, tagline that's in verse 3. Any ideas?
Is perhaps because several of the plagues did not affect the Israelites, and so maybe the Egyptian people wanted to cozy up with them because when they were in their area, they were safe from the several of the plagues.
That could definitely be something that's there. I don't have like this like clear cut answer to this. This is a question I have. any other ideas behind that?
Well, not to take over your class, but I've heard that that God allowed them to find favor in the eyes of the Egyptians, mm-hmm. because you know, as it says, they gave them like gold and silver and all mm-hmm. these things that later on were used to build the tabernacle.
Yeah, that's definitely true, and we'll get to that in a little bit. Kind of the only, I agree with your first point. The only other line I'm thinking is like, how has Pharaoh responded to the plagues thus far? He's been basically like, keep them coming, bring them on. Like, we don't care about this. Like, his heart is hard towards all of it. And Moses, when he's approaching Pharaoh, is giving him the option for these things to not happen. So as Pharaoh's looking at Moses and is saying like, hey, like, I don't care, whatever else, and God continues to bring these plagues, and he continues to not let the Israelites go, at some point, if I'm sitting to the side, and I keep, like, having my country getting punched in the face by this guy, and then the ruler is like, all right, like, we're going to keep going, like, keep going strong. At some point, I'm going to be like, all right, I'm switching sides. Like, I don't like this guy who's leading us. I don't like the peace that he's trying to bring about because it's not peace. This is chaos, but they seem to have chaos over there where they are, just like you mentioned. All right, here was my next question, and this is a weird one. I just want to explain this for a little bit, where my thought process went, because this has been something that's been on my mind a lot recently. Verse 6, there will be loud wailing throughout Egypt after the firstborns die, worse than there has ever been or ever will be again. But among the Israelites, not a dog will bark at any person or animal. Psalm 46:10 is like the most Hobby Lobby verse of all the Hobby Lobby verses. It's be still and know that I am God. Like, super Hobby Lobby. One of the crazy things about Psalm 46, when you really dig into that chapter, it's wild. I think I put it here. Yeah. So it starts with a very happy thing. God is our refuge and strength and ever-present help in trouble. But as you get along, it starts having this like deeper, meatier tone to it. So verse 8, come and see what the Lord has done, the desolations he's brought on the earth. He makes wars cease to the ends of the earth. He breaks the bow and he shatters the spear. He burns shields with fire. He says, be still and know that I'm God. I'll be exalted among the nations. I will be exalted in the earth. A lot of people take this. I don't want to ruin it if it's your like favorite verse in the world. But a lot of people take this verse, be still and know that I'm God. And this is like their meditation by the beach verse, where it's like, all right, I just need to like be still for a moment and take a breath of deep air and just like chill out for a sec. In a way, it can relate to that. But when you dig into this, all of this, especially it's a lot more like prominent in the Hebrew language. It shows that it's God actually speaking to the enemies of Israel in this. So when God says, be still and know that I'm God, that's not him looking at his people. That's him looking at the enemies of Israel and saying, be still, stop your chaos, and recognize who I am for a second. I am God. I'm the God who breaks the bow, shatters the spear, like does all these other things. Now, if that ruined it for you, I'm sorry, but to like make it up a little bit, when our enemies end up being shut down by God, how does our life become after that in the end? A little bit more peaceful. There we go. So in the end, it does relate to some peace and stuff. But when I'm reading this, I'm thinking a little bit about the earlier sections of when Moses first approaches Pharaoh. So Moses approaches Pharaoh, and this is his like first try at this thing, and he's like, let the people go. Pharaoh says, I don't know who your God is, gets all upset, and is like, now you guys are going to like make even more bricks. I'm not going to provide straw. It's going to be a lot tougher on you. And all of a sudden, you see the Egyptian, like, magnificent society, greatest society in that day and time, all joyful, still having their massive buildings built. And then you have the Israelites wailing and weeping and struggling through this. And these two verses signify that there's a shift there, that there has been a power exchange, and the opposite is now happening for each group. And it is because one of the most awful, horrendous things has just occurred. The firstborns, they're about to occur. They're going to die. Now, I didn't want to leave this chapter without pointing out this. Moses says all this to Pharaoh, lets him know the firstborns are going to die, and it says, then Moses, hot with anger, left Pharaoh. Why do you think Moses was hot with anger? Right here.
Well, so, I don't know, you know, this is me projecting onto Moses, but he knows how it feels to have taken a life, and so yeah. He knows, like, he's told Pharaoh, like, this is going to happen. And Pharaoh was just, you know, shuts it down. And so he's walking away knowing all of these children, all these firstborn are going to die. And, I mean, when you go from that perspective of I've been there, I've been in those shoes, you don't want this on you, and you're still making that choice, that's tough.
Yeah, like Moses, I think, is just like so horribly frustrated at Pharaoh. And what's really interesting looking at some of the language here is a lot of this, interestingly enough, when it comes to the death of the firstborns, actually is similar language to the very beginning of Exodus. Exodus chapter 1, when Pharaoh decides to cast the baby boys of the Hebrew people into the water. And one thing that I think God is trying to show here in the midst of just such a horrible thing occurring is that Pharaoh did not give these baby boys and families a chance. They had no way to decide if I'm going to die or if I'm not going to die. Like, you're just dead if you're a Hebrew baby boy at this day and time. God here is giving them an opportunity. He's saying, basically, like, this is going to happen, but you can make it not happen. You have the opportunity here to stop this. And yet Moses, I think, here seems to recognize that Pharaoh's not going to stop this. And he is just heated. He's upset. He's like, I cannot believe that this guy, in all of his stubbornness, is keeping this going. So now, Exodus chapter 12, starting in verse 1. The Lord said to Moses and Aaron in Egypt, this month is to be for you the first month of your year. Tell the whole community of Israel that on the 10th day of this month, each man is to take a lamb for his family, one for each household. If any household is too small for a whole lamb, they must share it with their nearest neighbor, having taken into account the number of people there are. You are to determine the amount of lamb needed in accordance with what each person will eat. The animals you choose must be year-old males without defect, and you may take them from the sheep or from the goats. Take care of them until the 14th day of the month, when all the members of the community of Israel must slaughter them at twilight. Then they are to take some of the blood and put it on the sides and tops of the door frames of the houses where they eat the lambs. That same night, they are to eat the meat roasted over the fire, along with bitter herbs and bread made without yeast. Do not eat the meat raw or boiled in water, but roast it over a fire with the head, legs, and its internal organs. Do not leave any of it till morning. If some is left till morning, you must burn it. This is how you are to eat it, with your cloak tucked under your belt, your sandals on your feet, and your staff in your hand. Eat it in haste. It is the Lord's Passover. On the same night, I will pass through Egypt. I'll strike down every firstborn of both people and animals, and I will bring judgment on all the gods of Egypt. I am the Lord. The blood will be a sign for you on the houses where you are. When I see the blood, I will pass over you. No destructive plague will touch you when I strike Egypt. This is the day you are to commemorate. For the generations to come, you shall celebrate it as a festival to the Lord, a lasting ordinance. For 7 days, you are to eat bread made without yeast. On the first day, remove the yeast from your houses, for whomever eats anything with yeast on it from the first day through the seventh must be cut off from Israel. On the first day, hold a sacred assembly, and another one on the seventh day. Do not work at all on these days except to prepare food for everyone to eat. That is all you may do. Celebrate the festival of unleavened bread, because it was on this day that I brought you and your divisions out of Egypt. Celebrate this day as a lasting ordinance for the generations to come. In the first month, you are to eat bread without yeast from the evening of the 14th day until the evening of the 21st day. For 7 days, no yeast is to be found in your houses, and anyone, foreigner or native-born, who eats anything with yeast in it must be cut off from the community of Israel. Eat nothing made with yeast. Wherever you live, you must eat unleavened bread. Then Moses summoned all the elders of Israel and said to them, "Go at once and select the animals for your families and slaughter the Passover lamb. Take a bunch of hyssop, dip it in the blood in the basin, and put the blood on the top of both sides of the doorframe. None of you shall go out the door of your house until morning. When the Lord goes through the land to strike down the Egyptians, he will see the blood on the top of the sides of the door frame and will pass over that doorway, and he will not permit the destroyer to enter your house and strike you down. Obey these instructions as a lasting ordinance for you and your descendants when you enter the land that the Lord will give you as he promised. Observe this ceremony. And when your children ask you, 'What does this ceremony mean to you?' then tell them, 'It is the Passover sacrifice to the Lord, who passed over the house of the Israelites in Egypt and spared our homes when he struck down the Egyptians.' Then the people bowed down and worshipped. The Israelites did just what the Lord commanded Moses and Aaron." I wanted to make sure to read all of this. That's a whole lot. I'm going to have to take a drink of water in a little bit, but I wanted to make sure to read all of this, because when I was kind of developing this class, I feel like the two sections that a lot of people tend to leave out when they teach this class are these long sections about the Passover early on, and then there's like some stuff about like the temple and the furniture and stuff towards the end. I wanted to spend a little bit of time on it. If you didn't know like what happens during the Passover, what it's for, or how it occurs, or what the different parts of it are, Exodus 12, Exodus 13 are great chapters to go to. All right, so I have a few questions for you guys. At the very beginning, God literally states, like, starting then, when this is to occur, this month is to be for you the first month of your year. Imagine God coming down, speaking to us, and just saying, like, "All right, scratch your calendar, tomorrow's January 1st. Like, would that cause a little bit of chaos in the moment? Like, for me, it definitely would. Why did God literally restart the Hebrew calendar? Or why do you think he did?
I mean, I think he's having them structure not only their, like, physical life of, like, doing stuff, but also their, like, how they view the world in time around him now, right? I mean, they're starting their year now remembering the salvation that they got. It's very similar to how we are supposed to start every single week remembering the salvation that we got. I think he's wanting us to structure our time and their time around him.
I love it. I think that is the perfect answer. And as we go throughout this, like, if you're a Christian, you can probably see how the Lord's Supper is going to start, like, coinciding with the Passover in a lot of ways. And if we can get to the end of this class, we'll talk about that some more. Next question. Why do you think that God asked them to slaughter a lamb? And I ask this for two reasons. First reason is God had been, like, for the most part, I should look this up beforehand, but for the most part, most all, if not all, the other plagues were in Egypt, but not in the Goshen region, to my memory. Why did God not just say, "I'm going to go into Egypt," or "I'm going to approach the bad guys and I'm going to strike down all their firstborn sons, and you guys can just sit in your houses and be happy and joyful. Why do you think he makes them kill and slaughter a lamb?
It has to show participation, like put forth a little effort. I don't know if I'm finding the right words, but instead of just giving it to them as a gift, they needed to show that they would obey, not only obey his commands, but like there was a purpose behind that. To, it's like a buy-in. You know, like, you got to do this.
I definitely think a buy-in is an aspect of it.
Takes the place
of the firstborn.
Yeah, I think that is a portion of it as well. Going off of both of those, they're asked to keep, imagine this, like these were like field animals in that day and time, like kept way out in the field. They're slaughtering them all the time. It is not normal. Like if you go to a third world country today, like having a dog in your house is really, really weird because dogs are things that are like running along the road. They're rampant. Like bringing an animal into your house is not a normal thing. Why does God, and I think this relates to the two things I've already been brought up. Why does God ask them to bring a lamb into their house from the 10th day until the 14th day?
I don't know about the specific days, but yeah. What I've heard before is like a lamb is like attractive is a weird word, but they're cute, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you like bring it into your house and the family develops almost like a relationship. It's like a little household pet. And so when it's time for the sacrifice, it really is a little more meaningful to that family because they've developed maybe a little bit of a bond over those 4 days. And they've kind of slaughtered.
Exactly. And going along with what's already been mentioned, this is, I won't call it my theory because when you really look into like ancient sources and stuff, like for the most part, this is something that almost all of them will agree on. A lamb in that day and time would have not been like a super cheap meal or something like that. Like they can't just go to a grocery store, especially when you're talking about slaves. A lamb would have cost them something. A lamb being in your house for 4 days in the midst of all of this would have caused you to develop some sort of a relationship with this lamb. Like my father-in-law right now, they just built their house on a piece of property that's really, really big, and he's like a really weird guy. I love him, but he's made all of these jokes about like how on this like massive piece of property he just wants to like go out in his boxers with a bow and arrow and like kill deer or something like that, and that's what he wants his retirement to be. But he literally mentioned this to us like a week or two ago. He said, "This is really weird, but like these deer are coming around my house every single day. And I don't know if I'm going to be able to kill them. Like they're like my little pets now. Like, I love the..." So they're developing a relationship with it. They've spent money on it. Yeah, I think another aspect of all of this is really any type of creature that you slaughter or kill in any way, you're probably going to have some emotional effect or toll on you because of that situation. I don't know, because there's not like a sacrifice for atonement yet. Like, we're not really into a section of the scripture where we're talking about sin. But we are in a section where I think God is wanting the Israelites to know, like, how big of a deal the thing that he's doing is in this instance. And if you're spending a lot of money, if you are living with this thing, if you are having to kill it in the end, like, that is something that will not be lost in your mind and in your conscience. You are going to remember this situation. And I think by God asking them to do such a significant thing in this moment, he's almost saying to them, like, hey, you guys will not forget this. If you do this, you're going to understand how big of a deal it is. So I guess I have two questions off of this one. One of them is, why do we think that God thought it was so important for them to remember this in such a dramatic way?
They have been in Egyptian captivity for generations.
Yeah.
And their behavior after they left Egypt would indicate that they had picked up some of the idolatry and some of the other things from the Egyptians in their time there. And so, to me, it does point to some aspect of, I'm going to have to cleanse you from this influence that you've been around. You know, the fact that they, you know, they were barely out and they were wanting to go back, you know. Mm-hmm. Be better off in Egypt, you know.
Yep.
I think it also, I think you mentioned it earlier, but this kind of denotes the moment where God enforces the curse that Egypt put on them in the beginning, which started with the killing of the firstborn.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think God is making it such an important moment that they need to remember this is the moment that he reversed the curse that they were under.
Oh, yeah.
Which put them into slavery.
Yep.
Which, again, I think goes up into why it's so important. It becomes very important for us.
Absolutely.
I also think that it's kind of twofold. It's, you know, one of the most obvious shadows for Christ in the entire Bible. But it also, not only does it point forward to Christ, but it points back to Abraham and and Isaac, and how Abraham was commanded to take Isaac up on the mountain and sacrifice him, but at the last minute, God allowed him to sacrifice a ram, even though it's not a lamb, but that it's a, you know, it's a significant sacrifice, and I think a large reason why they would have, you know, kept it in the house and is because it would almost force the kids to ask why are we doing this, why is this happening, and that would force the parents to explain.
And when your children ask you, what does this ceremony mean to you, then tell them it's the Passover sacrifice to the Lord who passed over the houses of the Israelites in Egypt and spared our homes when he struck down the Egyptians. These are dramatic things that are happening. And as their children see these things, they're going to obviously ask questions. This is something that God wants remembered, not only then, but through generations. I think that's perfect. All right, I want to do this. This is going to look really weird to most of you. It kind of looks weird to me, too. These are two words I thought were really interesting, and this is one of the reasons that a lot of people think that this section is the end of like one of the compositions of the scroll of Exodus or whatever. This word is habayit. It basically means like into the house or something like this. This word is teva. Teva is only used a couple times in the entire Bible, Noah's Ark, and then the basket that Moses is put into when he's a baby. Here's what's really interesting. In Hebrew, there's all these dots and stuff. Don't let them distract you. The main thing that matters is like the consonants, which are basically the letters without dots in the end. And what's really interesting is when you take these two words and you remove all of that gumpity-goo, you get these consonants in the end. And then it's just really interesting to me because I don't know the exact reason why, but most scholars believe this. This word that is used so rarely, teva, backwards is habayit in the end. And what's really interesting is this whole series starts with Moses in the ark in this basket, and this section right here, the Israelites are now being told to go into their houses. And what a lot of scholars believe is happening right here, which is just like kind of fascinating to me. There's other tie-ins and stuff like that. What a lot of people believe is happening is God is essentially telling them, like, your house shall be your ark. And you're going to be in this ark with your animal in the end. And this is a situation where I'm going to rescue you from everything that else that is happening around you. Just a really weird, kind of interesting, like, thing I discovered this week. If you're a nerd, you'll like it. Okay. Exodus 12. I'm going to read. Well, maybe I should. Okay. Let me just paraphrase, because I want to get along a little bit. So, basically, God strikes down all of the firstborn. There's weeping and wailing throughout Egypt. Pharaoh comes to Moses. He says, I'm going to let you go. But really interestingly, he ends his series with Moses by saying, and I want you to bless me. Which is just, we won't go into that question right now, but there's some significance there, right? Like Pharaoh at the end of the story is asking Moses to bless him. So they took their dough without yeast, because if you know more about baking than I do, you are way more apt to talk about this. But yeast stuff, I guess, grows, so you got to let it sit there for a little bit, and then you can bake stuff. Well, if you're in a hurry, you ain't got time to let it sit there. So that's why it was unleavened originally, because they were in a haste. The Israelites leave. We're told that 600,000 men, not including women and children, or possible other people and herds and flocks, all left together. Just millions upon millions of people, I guess. I think some people estimate it anywhere from like 1.4 to 2.7 million people are exiting Egypt at this day and time. But then at the end of this section, God once again talks about just instructions for Passover. Here is my big question, because this seems to be at the end of these first 12, 13 chapters, or at least we're nearing the very end. One of the big crux themes that we've talked about all of this thus far is God's name. What does the Passover situation tell the Israelites about who God is?
I think it tells them that I think he's responsible. Maybe go all the way back to Genesis 15 when God makes a covenant with Abraham. He tells them.
Good job.
Yeah, they're gonna be the end of everything after.
Yep. He makes so many promises to Abraham 400 years before. These Israelites, our Hebrew people, are struggling in this wilderness, like possibly still doing the circumcision ritual, but just, you can, even if they're remembering certain things, there's a lot of aspects and ways that the Egyptians have just beat them down and defeated them up to this point. But yet it seems that they're holding on to the many promises they made Abraham. One of them, even, I didn't know that this was one of them, but it's not only that they would like thrive one day and go back to this land, but it literally says that they are going to take the possessions of the Egyptians with them as they leave the land. And that end that I didn't read of Exodus 12 talks about that. So what else does it tell us about God? Yeah, I don't think there's a better answer than those two answers. He keeps his promises. Ultimately, his goal is to save his people. And it's really interesting to me that, yes, this is about him saving the Hebrews, but in every plague example, he offers the Egyptians two paths, two choices. I want to tell you guys, are there two bells on these nights? Okay, that was the first one. Okay, good. I want to tell you guys about this. This is just really interesting to me. That's the Sphinx. It's in a lot of video games and stuff, but it's real. This is a picture I took of it. It has no nose. It fell off at some point. But in front of the Sphinx, there's this little tablet thingy that's super interesting. It's called a stela. And if you go in front of the Sphinx, it's right here. And this is kind of what it looks like when you're looking at it up close. This is the dream stela. And this is one possible piece of interesting evidence that goes back to my timeline, which would be that Amenhotep II was the pharaoh in this day and age. We talked about it in a class a long time ago. What's really interesting here is Amenhotep II, his son that became the pharaoh afterwards was Thutmose IV. In Egyptian history, the way that somebody became pharaoh is they were just the firstborn son, and boom, they're pharaoh. what this dream stela written by Thutmose IV in front of the Sphinx describes is he starts essentially going on and on about how the gods, the Egyptian gods, have chosen him to be the pharaoh. And what's really, really strange about that is no other pharaohs would claim that, because just based upon your birth order, like, boom, you're pharaoh or whatever. Like, they don't have to make the claim that these gods have chosen me out of all the sons to be the next pharaoh. What's really interesting is if Amenhotep II was the pharaoh, and Thutmose IV is trying to prove a reason why he should be the pharaoh, it seems that he's trying to say, like, well, the firstborn son, for some reason, is not the pharaoh, or there's a fight for the throne because there's not a person who's holding this position, or whatever else. That's just a possible, like, pointer towards the idea of this whole situation. All right, and then we have Exodus 13. I think it's just really interesting there. God tells the Israelites that he wants their firstborn to be consecrated and redeemed as well. Later on, when we get into the other parts of the Torah, we start realizing that children, like oftentimes the first animal, would be sacrificed. And if it wasn't sacrificed, then they would take like a bird or a sheep and like a valuable animal, like a donkey's place, to sacrifice it. And for any son that was a firstborn, it could be son or daughter that was born to Israelites from this day forth, they were supposed to give 5 shekels to the temple, essentially, in order to redeem or to consecrate them in the end. What is the significance of God wanting here, not just the Egyptians, but everyone, specifically with the Hebrews, to recognize that their firstborn belongs to him?
I think it's them reenacting Passover in every generation to remind them that, like, it's not just then, it's now.
There's layers. It's inception. There's layers to everything. Like, Passover falls in a lot of things. What's also really interesting, didn't get to talk about it tonight, this whole Passover feast lasts from the 14th. If they keep they get lamb in their house 10th day, keep it to the 14th day, then they have this Passover feast from the 14th day to the 21st day. That's 7 days. We also know that on the last day they're supposed to celebrate and rest. Well, 7 days of creation right there in the end. There's themes within themes in the midst of all of this stuff, and it's all based upon God wanting his people to remember. And we didn't even get into it, and we're going to have a final class at the end of all of the Moses stuff on this. But Moses parallels to Jesus in a million different ways. And probably the most significant way is because Jesus decided at the Passover feast, that's where he's going to institute the Lord's Supper, and then within 24 hours later, he's going to be dead afterwards. And that is significant in terms of God wanting us simply to take time to remember. So I like the conversation earlier about our calendar should be based around that. Everything should be based around that. Like, God wants us to remember and pass this information on. So, all right, that's class.